Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What up? It's the Crossover Pod Friday edition. First week of the finals edition. We're here. We made it, folks. I'm in San Francisco. I will be along for the whole ride, however long this thing between the Warriors and Celtics lasts. As will Chris Mannix, my colleague on the Crossover Pod. He and I will be talking about the series on the podcast on the next episode between games 2 and 3, breaking it down, doing our usual thing. And of course, we here at the NBA team at SI will be covering it all on SI.com. So go check out all our coverage there. But it is Friday, which means I can dispense with all the punditry and predictions and breakdowns and all that and just welcome in another fantastic guest. Today, it's Andy Bernstein, good friend and longtime NBA photographer and Hall of Famer. Yes, he won the Kurt Gowdy Award back in 2018. So he is in the Hall of Fame. Andy has covered 40 NBA finals, 40, all of them since 1982, except this one. It's a streak that ended this week. Why? He will explain, and then we will jump into his treasure trove of stories because Andy has seen, covered, interacted with, and of course, photographed all the greats for the last four decades. Got so many great stories from his time sitting on the baseline about Giannis and that block last year and his shot on of that play. Kobe, Shaq, Jordan, Magic, LeBron, Steph, all of them. But also some few stories about celebrities that he's encountered along the way. A fun story, maybe not so fun from her perspective, about Adele, who he tried to photograph in the baseline seats last year. A lot of behind-the-scenes stuff, too. Also, Andy broke a little news at the end of the pod. It has to do with Kobe Bryant, who Andy was very close with and who he collaborated with on Kobe's Mamba Mentality book. The new project has to do with Kobe. It is incredible. I'm excited for you to hear about it. I'm excited to see it come to fruition soon. Before we get to all of that, a quick reminder, please rate, review, and subscribe to The Crossover wherever you get your podcasts, and hit me with all your feedback on Twitter at Howard Beck. Okay, my conversation with the great Andy Bernstein is coming up next, so stick around.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
Now, very pleased to be joined by a good friend, a Hall of Famer. Not just like figurative, but an actual Hall of Famer, an actual NBA legend in his own right. Also, by the way, just one of the best people I know in the league, period. Andy Bernstein. Andy, how are you, sir?
I am great, Howard. So great to see you. It's great to see you. When was it, last week? I think we bumped into each other in San Francisco. And yeah, so good to see you, man.
You too. Yeah, it was sometime early in the conference finals. I was bopping around out there for a bit working on a Steph Curry feature that is now up on SI.com that people should check out. Actually, by the time this publishes, it will have been out for a couple of days. But, you know, people, go catch up if you haven't read it yet. Great to see you. Good to see you virtually for this. I wanted to bring you on because when this posts, game one of the finals will be in the can.
What NBA a game that was, wasn't it? Wow. What an ending. No.
That one moment in the first quarter, you know.
Can you believe that?
Can you believe? This will publish after the finals have started. But right. I want to bring you on because as far as I know, Andy, there's probably no one in history who has witnessed more NBA finals in person and certainly more NBA finals games in person than you. You have covered every NBA Finals since 1982, 212 games total. That certainly, it predates both commissioners that I've covered. So you certainly have had more finals than Adam Silver and than David Stern did before him. Certainly than any players, probably any coaches. I don't know, maybe Hubie Brown. I don't know if, is there a second place? Has anybody seen more finals than you? And if not, who is second?
You know, probably Matt Winnick from the NBA office. You know, Matt's retired now.
Yes.
But he preceded me. He probably saw more games because he went back into the 80s. I'm sorry, into the 70s. Probably Matt would probably be the only person. Brian McIntyre, pretty close.
Yeah.
Terry Lyons, pretty close. Yeah. Our good friends.
Matt Winnick, who retired maybe 6-7 years ago from the NBA. People would have known him if they knew his name at all as the scheduling czar. By hand for decades until it became computerized by the current crew. You mentioned Brian McIntyre, Terry Lyons, of course, both phenomenal PR people and executives who worked for the NBA for a long time. But all three of those folks have moved on. So your streak certainly was the longest and maybe more than anybody. But as you and I speak, I am San Francisco bound later today. You are not. You are home in Los Angeles, I believe. First finals you have missed. You're breaking the streak. What is going on with that?
Well, it was a difficult decision, but it was a decision I was very much at peace with last summer when I was anticipating the season coming up. And the person I report to at NBA Photos, Joe Amati, great friend, been working together 35 years, I guess. You know, we were looking at the upcoming season. I had to, you know, negotiate a new contract and all that. And my goal, honestly, Howard, even before the pandemic, was to start scaling back and try to wean myself off the baseline. And as much as it's in my blood and how much I absolutely love it, it's physically very, very demanding. As you know, people think, oh, you're at the NBA Finals, you're staying in a 5-star hotel, you're flying on a charter. Yeah, but it's, you know, 18-hour work days and it's a grind. And not that, you know, look, I still love doing it. And quite frankly, if the Lakers or Clippers had made it to this level, I probably would be working right now because half the games would be at home. But that was a decision we made. I ended up agreeing to work only half the Lakers and Clipper home games. I did 2 road trips the entire season. I think I only did about 5 or 6 playoff games, which, quite frankly, they weren't obligated to assign me, but they did at the NBA. And it's a little bit of a weird feeling, but I've only been through this one time before in 2008. When my daughter was about to be born. And at that point, I had a streak of 137 straight finals games. You know, I mean, who's counting? But I did. because Terry Lyons and I were neck and neck at that point, you know, my good friend Terry. And I didn't work the Boston games, the away games, it was, you know, Lakers-Celtics series, because she was due. And she was born, Mimi was born, I believe, right before game 6. Of that series. So I was kind of not used to it, but I had already experienced like not being at a finals game. So this is going to be interesting. I'm hearing from a lot of friends, colleagues, people wondering what's going on and not seeing me there. And that's comforting and very sweet and nice. But I want to rest assure everyone, yourself included, that this was a conscious decision and a mutual decision. And I'm not walking away from my job or the NBA or what I've been known to be have done for 40 years. It's just been tailed back, which is something that's going to keep me fresh. And the NBA really wants me at my best. Not a spring chicken anymore. So it takes a little bit more time for the engine to start running in the morning. So that's it's all good. Really, it really is.
What you're telling me is you're being load managed. This is load management.
Yes. Kawhi and I have discussed this at length.
This was his recommendation.
Right. Right. Exactly.
I mean, look, Andy, you said it. There is a physical aspect to your job that is not the case for me, right? Like I'm sitting in a seat somewhere in the arena, used to be sideline or baseline. Now it's upstairs a little bit, whatever. But I'm in a chair at a desk, at a table for a couple hours, not a real problem. I get up, I go down to locker rooms or a press conference, whatever, but you are sitting there on the baseline for hours on end. Mm-hmm. You've got multiple cameras. Right. You occasionally have people crashing into you.
Yes.
Like that's not somebody go try sitting on a hardwood floor for like three straight hours and see how your back feels after. There is a physical aspect to your job. And so I want to just before we get into some fun finals memories and everything else, I want you to kind of just give people like a not full day in the life of, but the overview of what it's like to actually shoot an NBA game, especially a finals game. And both the good and bad of that, because as I say, like you're sitting on the baseline, best seat in the house, but that is not the easiest or most comfortable position.
Well, that's kind of where I end up after pretty much 9, sometimes 10 or 11 hours prior to that getting to the arena. So on an Eastern game, which, you know, as you know, they start at 9 p.m. in the East. Myself and my assistant are usually at the arena by 11 in the morning, maybe noon. If I get there after 12, I'm starting to get a little nervous, to be honest with you. And every game is a full setup and a full breakdown, because 9 times out of 10, as you know, games 1 and 2 are in the same city. Games 3 and 4 are in the same city. But most times they have an event at the arena scheduled. You know, Britney Spears, for some reason, every year she was doing a concert in between one of those games. You know, that was always the big joke. So it's very rare that we get to leave our setup up. And now in the age of third courts and alternate logos, the teams have decided, oh, well, we'll just pull the court out and put a new logo in the middle. Well, that means we have to pull everything out. That took hours and hours and hours to set up. So by the time the game starts, I have to have paced myself to the point where I can get a second win, third win, sometimes the fourth win. I have to remember to eat. I have to remember to sometimes I go under the stands. I mean, during the last series against with Dallas, I went under the stands and literally closed my eyes for about 20 minutes just to kind of do a Kobe-esque kind of mental preparation, you know? Yeah. And it's demanding, and it's a lot of equipment. We're schlepping around, you know, 8 to 10 heavy cases. You know, I don't schlep it a lot myself, but it's physical. And then there's the mental aspect of it being tremendously high pressure stakes. I mean, this is the top level of sports photography, and I never lose sight of that for a second, that I have to be locked in, tuned in, present, not distracted. You know, issues come up all over every single game almost, you know, technical issues or what have you. I'm getting a lot of things thrown at me in terms of what needs to be shot and peripheral stuff like celebrities and shoes and what guys are wearing and all that stuff, fans. But it's just an intense mental sort of locked in period that at the end you feel incredibly drained. And again, on these Eastern games, I mean, to get to the hotel before 2 a.m., 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning, that would be an easy night, quite honestly. And, you know, on a getaway day, you know, the next day being a travel day, after games 2, 4, and then it's 1-1-1 after that. You know, we were usually flying the next day. Of course, it's charter and it's great, but you know, it's still a long day of travel. Usually we, the NBA and all of their wisdom likes to leave at 7 or 7:30 in the morning. I have no idea why. So not going to miss all of that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. The quick turnarounds. Well, cause, so you mentioned something that I think I want to clarify for people because they think, well, you're a photographer. What is all this setup? You go in, you got a couple cameras in your lap, you sit there on the baseline, you shoot some pictures, but yeah. you have cameras mounted to the basket stanchions. I think you sometimes even have, correct me if I'm wrong, cameras mounted up in the catwalk, sure, way up there for those really amazing overview photos. I don't know how many of these are, like how many different cameras, where are they all mounted?
Sure.
Like just give people a quick sense of like why it takes so long to set up and that you're not just sitting there with your camera in your lap on the baseline.
Well, over the years, Howard, we've perfected at the NBA a system of remote cameras that we can do multiple remote cameras from different locations that fire the strobe system and open their shutter at precisely the same moment. So you can have, I don't want to say an infinite number, but we have done at NBA finals up to 36 remote cameras at an all-star game or a finals. I mean, this is back in the Bulls era. That's a little bit of an overkill. Now our system, the system that I do on the strobe set that I'm assigned to, my assistant and I, we set up about 7 or 8 remotes. Mm-hmm. And they, like you said, they're set up on the opposite side from where I'm sitting. So if I'm sitting on, let's say, the Warriors bench side, they would be on the Celtics bench end. And there's 3 cameras on the basket stanchion, one going through the glass of the backboard, another one at the top of the post, you know, before the arm comes out. And then a third that is an angle that I actually invented, which is a hole that's cut into the bottom of the basket stanchion pad where a camera is literally sitting on the floor in this hole protected by the pad, which is kind of cool. It's a very wide angle, really dramatic shot. And then 2 cameras in the catwalk, 1 or 2 on railings that are sort of in the stands area, you know, on walkways and such. And it's a little bit of a formula setup. Every arena is different, of course, but it's a huge prep. I mean, we get there, like I said, 9-10 hours before, lay all the equipment out and then start installing it. Mm-hmm. And not only am I doing that, but the other NBA photographers are doing it. Nat Butler does almost the same system setup that I do. And Jesse Garbrandt is doing his system, and Garrett Elwood has developed this amazing lighting setup. You've seen it, I'm sure, where it looks like almost like a spotlight.
Yeah.
That's like right in the middle of the key and super, super dramatic. And that's a whole other animal that he has to deal with lighting. So it's a big team, you know, and I started, Howard, it was me. know, like the 82, 83, 84 finals. It was just me. Then my buddy Nat came along, and by 85, it was the two of us. And then I think we brought an assistant along by about 87, 88, and then a couple of more photographers came along. And now it's like a cast of, God, we probably have over 30 people on the NBA Photos crew, of which I would say 12 of those people are photographers. But only 2 of us are on the court, because the court has been, you know, cleared basically of everyone except NBA Photos, Broadcast TV, and NBA Entertainment.
All right, so let's talk about that, because this is the fun part. To the extent that there could be a fun part, obviously, amid a very stressful environment where you are working, and you know, there's a lot of pressure, as you noted, especially during the finals, right? Like we all feel it, and I think that's an interesting aspect of this too for any of us who cover the NBA. My heart races when I get to a finals game, not because I'm nervous about the outcome. I don't care who wins and who loses. I don't care who goes for 30 or who, but it just, the environment seeps into you and it amps you up. And as a writer, obviously, like, it's the finals. I want my best, just as the players want their best performances to come out there. I want my best writing to come out at this time of year. And I feel it. I get nervous, especially on when I know it's a clinching game. And I think, oh, this is the moment. This is the, we got to capture this. Mm-hmm. And so I can only imagine for you, like I could sit there and ruminate for a little while. Sometimes there's a deadline eventually. Mm-hmm. You, everything you're doing is literally in the moment and mm-hmm. literally, milliseconds because you're shooting as it goes. And I know like for all of us who are around the game, you just, everybody has their own, you know, just nerves, mm-hmm. for a time like this, but you are sitting courtside. You are seeing every bit of action up close. There are also celebrities courtside. Give me some, just a tell me what you see and hear in your baseline perch mm-hmm. that the rest of us don't.
Well, you know, that the first part of your question, there's no do-overs in our business, as you know. I mean, I can't ask Steph to take that three again because I was late or I missed it or I was out of focus, or LeBron do a dunk or Kobe or Shaq or anybody, you know, going back to Magic. So, you know, from my vantage point, usually it's under the basket on one side or the other, either next to TV or, you know, my own position right there. I am seeing everything and it's my job to see everything and not miss anything. And I have to be not only locked in to really what's going on in front of me, but the peripheral as well. But I have to know what's going on. I have to know if Steph is, you know, if he hit nine threes in a row, I have to be like aware. Nobody's coming over. I don't have an earpiece in my ear like the broadcast guys. Hey, you know, Steph just hit nine in a row. It's an NBA record. I have to know that. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I have to be conscious of things like matchups. And, you know, back in the day, the hardest matchup for me to get was Magic and Bird because they never guarded each other. One was a guard, one was a forward. You know, this series is going to be interesting because, you know, you have Tatum, who's by far the star of the Celtics. You have Curry, who's the star of the other team. They're not going to guard each other either. So, you know, how do you get these guys in the same shot? You know, we got lucky with LeBron and Curry that they guarded each other a lot, you know? So I have to be conscious of all of that, as well as Celebrity Row, which is essentially at the finals, you know, basically every seat baseline and on the sidelines are either celebrities or, you know, super VIPs, owners, you know, people that I don't even really know, but I know that they're important because they're sitting there. And we have photographers that their only job is to shoot fans and celebrities. But huh. from my vantage point, you know, being able to get it from the court and in the moment, that's, I think that's a little more, you know, valuable. And you're not shooting it from afar, you're shooting it from right there.
Yeah.
So, you know, all that being said, there's just a lot of information coming in here and it all has to kind of come in and then it has to be locked into the camera because the most important thing obviously is the action that's on the court right in front of me.
Is there a celebrity you actually had an interaction with, like either while you're shooting them and they're conscious of this, or just because they were close by? Like, give me, you know, some quick, you know.
that's such a great question. You know, I will preface this by saying most celebrities are very nice and very accommodating, and if they're making the conscious decision to sit courtside at an NBA Finals game and hundreds of millions of people are going to be watching them, you know, they can expect to have their picture taken. Okay. Again, I sort of do it on the fly. I do it when I can do it. And last year at the finals, Adele was sitting right behind me. Right. And it's really awkward when this a major celebrity is sitting like behind me, because I physically have to turn around, have to make eye contact. I always ask, you know, if they're that close to me, I always like either motion or I ask, like physically ask them verbally. She wanted nothing to do with me. She was like, put the hand in the face. Don't take my picture. Meanwhile, fast forward, there's literally 75 other photographers that are taking her picture during the game. And not, you know, some of them were not that flattering of angles or expressions. And some of these photographers are actually looking for those gotcha moments, right? That's not what I do. I want a nice smiley picture. You know, I'm happy to be here at the finals. So I would hope that celebrities would kind of have that in mind. You know, Drake has always been great. Of course, Denzel and Jack and all the guys that are used to seeing me, you know, she didn't know me from anybody. So I respect that. I am wearing the NBA vest. So it kind of gave me a little bit of legitimacy. And I'm not trying to, you know, badmouth Adele because I actually love her. My daughters, you know, adore her music. But it's just weird to me. Like we had a situation way back in the day. I remember Barbara Streisand came to a game and she sat courtside at the game with the program in front of her face the entire game, you know, and like, what's the point? Like, why even come there? Anyway, it's just people do what people do and celebrities do a lot of weird stuff. But by interaction, usually 99% of the time is pretty positive.
Was Adele with Rich Paul by then? And do you have to be conscious of, okay, so now you have to be conscious of too, like, well, I don't want to piss off Rich Paul either because he's kind of important. He's LeBron's agent and he's a power agent. And like, it gets really, you know, a little complicated there on the relationship.
Yeah, and he obviously knows me. Rich knows me.
Sure, of course.
He gave me a nice nod and all that. But she wasn't having it.
All right, so let's talk players and just kind of game action. Are there moments, because you are, there are times where the action is literally right on top of you, right? So again, you need to capture what you can in these split seconds. There's no time to think about it. And I imagine there's no time in some sense to actually even enjoy or appreciate what's happening. I'll never forget when Joey Crawford retired as a referee after, you know, legendary long career. And I asked Joey, I said, so tell me some of your favorite moments or tell me some of your favorite games. I don't think he had any. And his point was like, listen, even if you're conscious that like Jordan's going for 60 or someone just had this incredible dunk or, you know, Steph just hit 10 threes. Just like, the referee's job is so immersed in the mechanics of it. There's no time to sit there and go like, I just witnessed history.
Yours
is an aesthetic job though, Andy. It is a job of appreciation baked into it. And so I understand, like, probably you cannot necessarily take a moment to go, wow, either. Mm-hmm. But tell me a moment where you maybe were able to kind of, like, straddle the line there, get the great shot, but also say, holy shit, I just saw history.
Well, that's happened many, many times, but I honestly really, really try, Howard, not to get caught up in the moment. A play could happen, and it's my job to record it, to document it, to, you know, preserve it forever as a photograph. And then maybe on the way back down court, I'm like, oh, that was amazing. Or usually it happens later. It happens way later when I'm back at the hotel room and I turn on the TV and I'm watching the highlights and I'm like, oh, wow, that was, you know, and I see the strobes go off and I'm thinking, wow, I hope I got that. Case in point was Giannis's block last year. I forgot what game. I think it was game
that
four?
Was three or four.
Yeah. So it was in Milwaukee. I think it was game four. And I don't know, man. I just timed it right. And it was on the opposite side of the court. So the remotes actually captured. I wasn't shooting that through my camera in my face, but I was pushing the button. And block shots are one of the most difficult, if not the most difficult moments to get, because it always happens after the fact, like a millisecond after the shot or a layup or a guy goes in for a dunk and, you know, the other guy meets him at the rim. So I try to anticipate a little bit what's going to happen before the block shot. So in this case, I don't know what happened. Maybe I was just a little late or something, but I was able to time it that I got Giannis with his hand on the ball. You know, and Ayton was going up and it was insane. And it was, I got it from three different angles with the remotes. One was really a spectacular angle, was a side angle, which you don't really get too much, you know, great stuff from that angle. Of course they replayed it on the screen and I looked up after they replayed it and I saw the strobes go off. I knew that I had timed it right. And I can't see it in the camera in my hand because I didn't shoot it with that camera. I can't look at the screen. So I have to, I'm at the mercy of the after the game or, you know, at a timeout, I'll furiously like go through Getty Images on my phone to see if the editor posted it because it's being transmitted back to the editor in real time, either in the bowels of the arena somewhere or back in NBA photos at in New Jersey. There's an editor ingesting everything that I shoot. So that was pretty cool. And then there's moments like, you know, Michael Jordan holding the trophy, 91's first championship that was shot on film. So I didn't know it was as poignant a photo. I mean, the moment was poignant and important. You know, it was his first championship. We didn't know there's going to be five after that. You know, no one knew. But it was such a dramatic, wonderful, emotional moment that I was happy I got it. And then when I saw the actual frame on film, when I went to the lab later that night, it was very gratifying to know that I had got, you know, I had pushed the button at the right time. And every series will have a moment like that. There'll be some iconic, crazy dunk. You know, I'm just thinking of so many that Shaq had in you know, all of his finals. Kobe, of course. There's a shot from the 2000 finals, shot with my floor remote, and Kobe sort of going in midair, going behind the back, passing to Shaq, who was trailing.
I remember that one.
And that was the picture. The picture was not Shaq then going up for the ferocious dunk. The picture was the actual pass, you know, the teammates, the whole thing. So if I come away from a finals with images, I'll tell you, if I come away with five or six keepers, as we call it, ones that I can point to, you know, year after year as sort of my favorites or iconic, and then they become iconic over time, I'm a happy guy.
Absolutely. Well, especially if it's, you know, that Giannis block is one that we'll be talking about forever, right? It is one of the defining moments of the 2021 finals and of his first championship. So we will always remember that play. And if you got the one play, the snapshot of the one play that kind of defined that series, that championship, that's huge. It makes me think a little bit about, since the Warriors are back in the finals, like, okay, LeBron's chase down block of Iguodala, you know, one like that. Do you recall, like, were you shooting that from opposite baseline or the baseline it happened on? Do you remember if you got the shot that you wanted on one like that?
So that happened on the opposite side from where I was sitting. And in that scenario, close game, our protocol, and this goes way back to the Jordan era and the shot, you know, the 0.6. Everybody knows that picture shot from the other side. Michael Jordan's going up. He had just faked out Byron Russell. It says 0.6 on the clock. Our protocol now is whoever's on the opposite side from where a potential last second shot could happen, we have to go wide. Right. We have to shoot a wide shot with the camera in our hand, shows sideline to sideline with the clock so that you can see. Sometimes the scoreboard is low enough in the background that you can see the actual score. So I shot that in that way. I did not shoot it with the remotes on that side because, you know, like I said, my assignment, my protocol is to shoot it wide. I actually never seen that image. So I'm assuming I didn't really get it, or I got it and it wasn't. It happened such a bang bang play, and as I remember, LeBron kind of smothered Iguodala as he went up. So from my vantage point, it might not have looked very good. Other people had a tremendous angle on that. I mean, our photographer, I believe it was Joe Murphy, who was elevated shooting on an angle. I mean, he just nailed it, and he was able to shoot motor drive because he wasn't on strobe. So I'm really happy when one of us gets it. You know, the Jordan picture is a case in point. You know, I actually pushed the button, the remote button that was attached to Fernando Medina's camera, that he was able to fire and shoot that photo because he was acting as a human remote, as we call it. He literally was. He was a human being holding a remote camera, and his job was to compose and focus. But he wasn't pushing the shutter, that the actual trigger of the shutter was coming from me. So that was a team effort, and we're all super proud of that. And we can point to that as really as the coming out party, really, of this system, and that actually worked.
What are your favorite shots? You mentioned the Giannis block. Give me your other favorite finals shots. The ones that I often say this, they may not know your name, but they know your work. They know your photos, and they've seen these shots in, you know, a variety of places. So give me a couple of the iconic ones that that are your favorites.
Well, man, it's crazy. I was doing a little bit of research on the moments, but I think it was, 2016, Kyrie hit that shot in game winner.
Game seven.
Was that game seven? Yeah, that was unbelievable. You know, Kobe had so many moments, so many game winners against Detroit. I remember that was amazing. Magic's junior sky hook in 85 was pretty unbelievable. There were individual performances that were just off the chart. You know, even in the bubble, Jimmy Butler's performance in that entire finals was amazing, as you remember.
Yes.
I remember Steph had a game. I think he scored 47 in a game that both Durant and Clay were out in. What year was that? 2018, maybe, or whatever year that was. But that was nuts. He was single-handedly, of course, Isaiah's performance in 89 on one leg. I tend to look at more in the overall scheme of how guys perform during a finals or a particular game. You know, the triple overtime game in 93 when the Suns beat the Bulls, that was nuts. That was insane, crazy. Michael had an amazing game, so did Charles, but somebody had to win. So it's more of memories of either a series or a particular performance in a game than an actual, you know, there are the ones we talked about, you know, individual photos. But, you know, the finals, a whole other experience, because every possession is insane. And, you know, it's like baseball. You know, I don't really watch any baseball during the regular season, but I watch the World Series because literally every pitch could be important, you know, at that point. Stanley Cup, too, you know, with hockey, especially when it gets to an overtime in the Stanley Cup playoffs. So anyway, a lot of great memories over the years, my friend.
Yes, no doubt. Is there a favorite player to shoot? I mean, look, they're all the great stars, almost by definition, have a certain just charisma to their game, to their personality, maybe both, maybe only one or the other sometimes. But there's a reason that in basketball, we find the stars captivating in the first place in a way that I don't think always applies in the other sports. There is always something just mesmerizing about watching Jordan or LeBron or Steph Curry, Kobe, even Shaq. A lot of people aesthetically in that time felt like, it's no fun to watch him. He's just beating the crap out of everybody. He's bruising, plowing through them. Although there was a lot of grace to his game that got overlooked, of course. Sure. So they're all, you know, fun to watch it to a certain extent, but who's the most fun to actually photograph in the moment at these big moments?
Well, all the guys you mentioned definitely are, you know, 1A, 1B, but, you know, let's not forget about Tim Duncan, you know, let's not forget about Hakeem Olajuwon, even Patrick Ewing. They didn't win that final, but he was unbelievable in that finals against Houston. You know, Dirk Nowitzki, D. Wade was otherworldly in what was that, 2006?
2006.
Yeah. I mean, guys just step up their game to a level that maybe they don't even know that they are capable of at that point. Then you have guys who come out of the woodwork, you know, the Mario Ellis of the world, or, you know, Kobe passing the Meta World Peace in 2010, who hits the shot, you know, to actually beat the Celtics in 2010 for the finals. Steve Kerr, Judd Bushler, all these guys. Yeah. If I had to rank them, I mean, I don't think, and it would be unfair not to put Michael number one. I mean, he was just so athletically amazing. And as a photographer, you know, you couldn't imagine a better subject, especially when the stakes are that high. You know, Kobe is very close second. You know, Kobe was just an assassin on the court. even his expressions and his body language and everything were amazing. And then, you know, I'm privy to a lot of behind the scenes moments too, which are very important, how guys prepare. You know, Kobe, of course, you know, I spent a lot of time with him behind the scenes. Sometimes it's just he and I and his trainer at a finals game, and watching the process, really how he really got himself ready to play, you know, game after game. Phil Jackson was unbelievable. You know, it could be the tensest of moments, and I'd go into the coach's locker room and Phil is there kicking his feet up, doing a crossword puzzle. I mean, everybody has their thing, you know, and then that's the other guys are super intense, you know, or they're not, you know, Greg Popovich, Eric Spoelstra, all these great coaches, Steve Kerr, unbelievable. You know, Steve Kerr, I don't think you can mention the Warriors dynasty, you know, six finals in 8 years without Steve Kerr being in that sentence. Not too many championship teams or dynasties, the coach is part of that conversation. Yeah. The coach is part of it, but it's not in the first sentence. And Steve, you know, what he's brought to the team, the culture, you know, his grit, his pedigree. I don't think the Warriors would be the Warriors without Steve.
I agree. It's one thing to win a championship or go to a couple finals as a coach, and you can maybe debate what role they played. But I think when you're the coach of a dynasty, you're not just along for the ride. Like yeah. you are as intrinsic to that as anyone. I think that's absolutely the case with Steve, and probably doesn't get enough credit. And he probably doesn't care. Like he's no. You know, his humility is top shelf. I don't think Steve would care whether we give him enough credit or not. I think he just loves doing what he does and working with the great players that he does. And if you ask Steve, as he said to me recently, this did not make the story that I wrote about Steph, but like Steve said, like Steph is the culture. Like you talk about our culture, Steph is the culture. Like just like Tim Duncan was the Spurs culture, and it made it so much easier for Pop to coach everybody else. It's the same thing. You mentioned your behind the scenes access. Again, something that you get as an official NBA and team photographer that most of us in the media do not. So give me a favorite moment that you had. Let's keep it to finals it is, you know, the player alone with the trophy, or maybe both trophies if they won finals MVP, and maybe it's their family or their wife or their daughter, or because there's a lot of those. And I can only imagine the catalog cycling through your head as I'm saying this. So I'm going to just keep delaying and give you time, but like, give me one of those that was like, you just felt like, I can't believe I get to be here for this. Cause these are sometimes very intimate private moments, and you get to sit there and kind of capture them.
Well, I'm going to give you two that come to mind. First one definitely has to be 2010, Game 7, Phil's pregame speech to the team, literally minutes before they ran out on the court to play Game 7. And I had never been in a locker room before a Game 7 of a finals. Coaches are not particularly welcoming to any of us, you know, from the NBA. It's really the coaching staff, training staff, and the players. That's really it. And at that time, I was working on a book with Phil, Journey to the Ring is what it was called, of the Lakers team, their journey in the 2009-10 season. And that was just a moment I had to have. It really was part of the story. We didn't know, obviously, win, lose, or draw, what was going to happen that day. It was either win or lose, not draw. So I asked Phil, I just said, look, you know, can I come in literally for 30 seconds when you start your speech? And I positioned myself, as you remember, the Laker locker room, the way it used to be set up, like right by the furthest locker, the closest locker to the exit, you know, so I could be like crouched down, bang a couple of shots, and then out. And he said, if I have to look over at you, you've been here too long. So I knew that I got to get in and get out and be a fly on the wall and not make a peep. And that picture ended up in our book, you know, double page spread. And that was an incredible moment. The other moment was last year that I'm remembering. I left the court. Now the way we work it is that, you know, the teams, the NBA now does the trophy ceremony on the court, no matter if it's the home team or the visiting team. And so, you know, Milwaukee won it on their home court. All the hoopla happens on the court. They set up the little stage. They do the trophy presentation. And the way we run it now at the NBA is as soon as the team starts assembling for this sort of impromptu team photo, I beeline it off the court, right? I get off the court. Nat, Jesse, everyone else is there shooting that situation and the post-game interviews. But I need to be in the locker room before the star player gets in there. Otherwise, I'll get caught, you know, in the VOM or in the hallway or whatever. So I'm in the locker room and I'm watching it on TV. I'm watching, you know, the team photo happen, some post-game interviews, and then I see the team leaving the court. And the first guy in the locker room was Giannis, right? And, you know, there's plastic all over the lockers and on the floor, the champagne. And he comes in, he's by himself. It's just me and him. This literally happened. And he picks up a bottle of champagne and then he doesn't know what to do with it because there's nobody to spray it on. And I'm like, not me, but, you know, like, not yet. And then he just sat down in his locker and he was very... He just let it all go. He's very emotional. It was just a catharsis, you know. And then finally, a couple of guys came in and they were able to party. But it was a little bit of an awkward moment because I'm like, "Hey, congratulations!" I'm like, what am I supposed to say to the guy? It was just funny. It was a funny moment.
that's fantastic. You know, it actually occurs to me as we kind of wind down here, though. So you collaborated, of course, on Kobe's book, The Mamba Mentality, with Kobe a few years back. I can see it over your shoulder there. I've got my copy off to my left here off camera. I don't think you have a book of Andy Bernstein's life and times as NBA photographer. Like, this is something before you retire, I feel like, because you have these incredible behind the scenes looks and anecdotes and experiences with the game and with these players that most people don't. When's the Andy Bernstein biography coming out?
You know, it's so interesting you bring that up, Howard, because a couple of people have actually sort of mentioned that to me, you know, a memoir in some way. I think it's coming down in the future at some point. I'm not ready yet because I haven't hung it up yet. As much as some people think I haven't. And, you know, when I got the Gowdy Award at the Hall of Fame in 2018, I think the first thing I said in my speech was, this doesn't mean I'm getting a pink slip, right? I mean, like, you're not retiring me by giving me this award. So anyway, hopefully that'll come down the pike. But I honestly do have a very exciting project to share with you and the audience.
Please do.
That you really are the first person I'm telling about.
Breaking news on the crossover pod from Andy Bernstein.
That's right. You know, when we lost Kobe and Gigi so tragically, very early in 2020, we saw almost immediately and simultaneously throughout the world that murals were being created and put on the walls, all four corners of the world, quite frankly, very, very much so in Southern California. But then we're seeing murals in Europe, in Asia, in South America, Australia, all kinds of places. And it was an incredible outpouring of emotional love through a creative process of mural art, quite frankly. To this day, there are probably... there's about 640 or 50 murals throughout the world celebrating the life and of Kobe and Gigi, the lives. And I actually have one right outside my door that I commissioned because I need to see him every day when I come to work, you know, and that it's the mural is made from one of my photos. So I approached Vanessa Bryant about somehow documenting these murals. And she and I have been working on finalizing an agreement, which we did, on a book that will do justice and really honor the memory and legacy of Kobe and Gigi through mural art, as well as other art that is now surfaced throughout the world. And this is a collaboration with Vanessa, myself, and my Legends of Sport platform. So, you know, stay tuned. I'll keep you posted. And wow. Of course, we'll be posting about it throughout the process. We're thinking sometime late 2023, the book will actually come out. But it's truly the first project since she lost her husband and daughter that she's putting her personal stamp on that she believes in. And I'm honored beyond belief and flattered and humbled that that she chose to do it with me. So very excited to be getting that started this summer.
Wow. That's fantastic. Well, congratulations on that. And I got chills just even as you were describing it. And obviously no better person that Vanessa could have chosen to work with on this than you, obviously having documented so much of Kobe's life and career. That's phenomenal. There's one of those murals is in fact across from Barclays Center.
Yes.
Up on Flatbush.
Yes.
I saw it every time I went to a Nets game this season. I don't even know when it went up. I just remember walking up one day and like be kind of startling, like, oh, wow, there it is. And
yeah.
It's
That's from John Suhu, who you know, John Suhu from L.A. That's from John Suhu's really famous portrait of Kobe. I think it was his second season. And John took this amazing portrait. And look, I'm almost speechless every time I see a mural that is made from one of my photos, quite frankly, because I remember the moment. I remember the game. I remember how important that photo was at the time. And the fact that somebody took that photo and wanted to interpret it in their own vision as a tribute to Kobe and put it on a wall for the whole world to see is I don't know. It's a mind-blowing sort of experience, quite frankly. And again, it's happening over and over. You know, Howard, I don't think there's any public figure, really, I think it's fair to say, in the history of the world that has elicited that the level of creative love, you know, especially through mural art. I mean, think about it. I mean, you know, JFK, Martin Luther King, we can go down the list that, you know, artwork, we don't think of artwork when we think of somebody we lost too soon or, you know, somebody that we want to honor, Muhammad Ali. There, yes, there's murals, there's art, and but to have it all happen basically at the same time, and murals are going up almost every day all over the world.
640, you said.
Oh, at least.
That's,
that's the last count, yeah.
That's incredible. Who's documenting all that? Like, how do we know there's 640?
Well, I have a very good friend who's become a great friend. Mike Asner started a site called KobeMural.com. I'm going to plug that for him,
right,
as well as at KobeMural on Instagram. And Mike has plotted every single mural, almost like a Google Earth, on a map. And there's a little pinpoint. And you can go to that pinpoint and the mural will come up, the history of the mural, the muralist, whatever it is, the location. People are planning trips around these murals. Like, they're going to go to Europe, just like I would go to Europe and follow Bruce Springsteen on tour. People are actually going, making pilgrimages to these murals because of Mike's work that That's he's cool. done out of a labor of love, because he, like all of us, he was devastated when the accident happened. Lifelong Kobe and Laker fan. And he felt this was a way to give back not only to the fans, but a central place where the creative community can come together.
Wow. That's incredible. That's fantastic. And I was not aware of the site, KobeMural.com. So people should go check that out. I'm going to go check that out as soon as we're done. And I'll just say, just as my final thought on that subject before we go, and I've probably said it on this podcast before, I covered Kobe for 7 years for the LA Daily News. That's when you and I got to know each other, Andy, of course. That was 97 to 04. I've been in New York for 18 years. I obviously covered Kobe off and on for the New York Times when I was at Bleacher Report. And so it's not that I didn't have an appreciation for the impact Kobe has on the game and on people. I saw a lot of that up close. And certainly I will never forget being in one of those, what used to be parking lots across from Staples Center in 2000 under like 98 degree heat for that first parade, after which I said, I'm never covering a parade ever again. This is brutal. But there were, I don't know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands.
Hundreds of thousands.
Yeah. Yes. It was incredible. So that's the only time I got to see it, feel it literally up close. When he died in 2020, and obviously in such tragic fashion, it wasn't until in the wake of that, Andy, that I think I truly understood the impact he had worldwide. So would you say there's 640 murals that you guys are going to document and put into this book that will be fantastic?
Yeah.
It kind of underscores once again the impact that he had on people, the inspiration that he gave to people, the source of inspiration that he became, that I don't think up close, as you're covering somebody as a figure, as an athlete, writer to reporter to athlete, I could go to a bazillion games and write a bazillion stories. You don't understand the human impact sometimes of sports and of these athletes on people and the importance that they hold to them until something like this horrible thing happens. Right. And in a case of Kobe, it's like, well, I thought I knew and I didn't know. And it was so moving in those days and weeks that followed, whether it was murals that popped up or the impromptu memorials, everything else. And that's when you realize, damn, like this, his impact went so far beyond the basketball court.
No, for sure. I mean, I'm thinking about our Mamba Mentality book, which was, you know, very well received and it was a New York Times bestseller coming out of the gate, you know, during that holiday period of 2018. And it was published in a couple of countries. And then when he passed, all of a sudden the book is now all over the world. I think it's almost, it's in 30 countries, published in 30 different languages.
That's amazing.
Places that you wouldn't even imagine that it would have been published. And that speaks to everything you just said about his legacy, what he meant to people, how people related to him, not just as an athlete, but as a human being, somebody who was larger than life, but also was a lot like us, you know, who had flaws and did have to pick himself up off the floor and beg for forgiveness and move forward and reinvent himself. And always with this Mamba mentality of relentless pursuit of greatness, which all of us in one way or the other try to do in our lives, in our business life and our work life, our family life. But he, you know, he set the bar so high for everyone, but he, you know, he just speaks to so many people. Even in death, I mean, he, look at Jason Tatum, you know, how he channeled Kobe in that game 7, wore his armband.
A Celtic wearing a Laker player armband.
It's almost blasphemous. I mean, the only thing that comes close to that is when Larry Bird retired and Magic was wearing the Celtic t-shirt as sort of a joke, you know, and I was there for that. And no one could believe that at the time either. But to see what Kobe's legacy is to a player like Jason Tatum, to a player like Devin Booker, who puts "Be Legendary" on his shoes every single game. I mean, I know for a fact, because I was there with Kobe when he met these guys as young rookies, and he would just look over and say, "This guy's going to be special," you know. And on the women's side as well, let's not forget, you know, what an impact he had with young women basketball players, with WNBA stars that he was just so impactful towards. And so the game is richer because he was in it, and his legacy continues, and it will continue to continue because no one's going to forget about him. He's going to become a mythical figure, you know, but the lessons that he left behind of the person he was will always be there and always be at the forefront.
Yeah, well said. Well, this podcast is richer for you being on it, Andy.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, my friend.
No, thank you for spending the time. Folks, he has his own podcast series, by the way, which is fantastic. Many luminaries come and visit Andy on his pod. It's called Legends
Including
of Sport. Luminaries way more luminary than me. I don't have the looms to match the luminaries on your, but thank you. I appreciate you having me on a couple of times. Legends of Sport podcast by Andy Bernstein. Go find that. Obviously, the Mamba Mentality book on Twitter. He is ADB Photo Inc. INC at ADB Photo Inc. And you can see a lot of his work and links and everything else there. Anything else I should plug before I let you go, Andy?
On our Instagram, on at Legends of Sport, and also my Instagram at ADB Photo Inc., we're going to be posting a lot of stuff during the finals, a look back at my 40 years, and having a lot of fun doing that, actually putting that together. We're going to theme it, you know, great rivalries and great series and dynasties and all that kind of stuff, coaches. So, you know, I think fans will have a lot of fun. And we're also featuring that on our website, legendsofsport.net. So, it's so great to connect with you, man, and,
you too.
And talk hoops and our mutual history covering the finals. It, you know, it's priceless. The personal relationships, as you know, are, you know, an incredible byproduct of the job that we do. And I'm so happy for the people like yourself that I get to experience all that with. So no. Thanks for having me on, man.
No, thank you. Feeling is absolutely mutual. Andy, I will miss getting to see you at the finals, but I'm sure we will be crossing paths in an arena somewhere sometime soon. Thanks so much for spending the time. Appreciate you.
Thank you, Howard. Take care, pal, and safe travels.
You too. Okay, that's it for today's show. My thanks again to Andy Bernstein. Thanks to our producer, Shelby Royston. And thank you all for listening. Remember, you can hear Chris Mannix and me every Tuesday on The Crossover with all the latest NBA chatter. And then on Fridays, it is me and a guest. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to The Crossover wherever you get your podcasts. And hit me with all your feedback on Twitter at Howard Beck.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices. Plus, extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. And up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.